Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Differently from everybody else.
Hey, as a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo here with nobody. An open chair. Sam is locked up in a cabin somewhere in Kentucky. And here I am podcasting all by myself here on this Monday morning in May. But we're going to make it work. They gave me the mic. I got my solo camera. So I could just address you. I could talk about whatever I want. I could talk about the mid-90s Jaguars. Maybe we'll talk about the mid-90s Jags later in the episode. Maybe I'll take Sam's negativity and turn it into a positive since he's not here. I'll give you something to be optimistic about for all 32 teams. We'll do that later in the show. But first, I want to get to my friend Brad Spielberger. So I figured I do have to have a guest. I can't roll this whole thing by myself. But we got Brad from PFF, our cap analyst, our cap expert, and we're going to break down a whole bunch of NFL draft trades, offseason moves, get into the Chiefs O-line and all the moves they're making. So let's get to Brad right now, and then I'll take it home with a little solo podcast. All right, welcome in to Brad Spielberger of PFF. Always a joy to have Brad on the show. He was here in studio with us during a lot of our free agency coverage. Brad, how you doing, buddy, after all the draft stuff?
I'm doing great, although the draft stuff had that beautiful table where we had to stand at the big stand-up table for free agency. So I guess the draft crew gets a better setup than us free agency folk.
Oh, yeah, we shipped in a beautiful table and not the most comfy chairs, not going to lie. It wasn't all as glorious as it seemed, Brad. My knees are still hurting after 22 hours of coverage, but it was a good little setup there. So for those that don't know, Brad is our salary cap expert. Brad, knows the cap inside and out, knows everything about player transactions and the whole thing. And Brad, you've also worked with Jason McIntyre of Over the Cap. You're formerly of Over the Cap, and you guys created your own draft trade chart. Right. And so I want to get into that a little bit and the history of it, how you guys have done that, and then get into some of the best trades coming out of last week's draft.
Yeah, absolutely. So the chart we created called the Fitzgerald Spielberger trade chart over at overthecap.com, which is all online. It's publicly available if you wanted to check it out. But long story short, it was created using player contracts. So essentially looking backwards and just letting the NFL tell us the value of these picks. So really all we did was, follow a pick to the conclusion of their rookie deal and then take the value of that second contract they end up signing and essentially say, okay, this player, on average, this pick number is going to go on to sign a deal for this amount. And so that essentially is kind of say, okay, well, that's what they were worth, or that's kind of what they're expected to be worth through their rookie contract. So yes, there's of course, their first season, they may not be as good as they're going to be in, year five, but it still does a good job of kind of capturing the value that teams obviously you know, saw during those first 4 years. So we just did that for every pick and averaged it out and did some adjustments for position, stuff like that. But that's kind of the, you know, the cliff notes of how we created that chart.
Have you seen teams adjust a little bit in how they trade? Of course, everybody knows the Jimmy Johnson chart, and that was points based, and, you know, this pick's worth X and that pick's worth Y, and you just kind of make it all add up at the end. And I know there are still teams working off the Jimmy Johnson chart and other teams working off of either something that they've spun up on their own, something that you and Jason have worked on, or others. Have you seen teams adjust in how they've, you know, valued trades in the draft over the last few years?
So unfortunately, you know, I think before this draft, you know, the nerds of football analysis really came out in full force. And there was both at PFF and elsewhere, there were a million articles about, you know, how crazy it is the NFL is still using the Jimmy Johnson chart as the go-to, you know, controller of the marketplace. And all evidence suggests that that continued through 2021. We do know that some teams will look at other charts, you know, ours, or there's a Harvard chart that some teams look at. It's actually pretty similar to ours based on the values and some others. And they'll look at it and they'll try to make a trade with a maybe less smart team, we'll say, wherein it still fits the Johnson framework, but on their end, they recognize they're getting good value. They're exploiting an edge that just happens to still fit, you know, in this archaic old chart. But no, end of the day, if a team wants to make a trade during the draft, it still has to be relatively close to even or you know, zero sum on that Johnson chart.
Yeah, and that would be an edge, though. I mean, if teams are using something that has been proven to either be a little bit smarter or take contract value into consideration or whatever it might be, if people do have that edge and other people are working off of Jimmy Johnson, I imagine that is a huge edge going forward in the coming years. So, but as you said, every team's got an analytics department right now, and they're, I know they investigate this stuff every year, but it is funny how teams do come back to Jimmy Johnson, you know, 30-year-old trade chart.
No, it's very funny. I think it's honestly one of the bigger edges to exploit still in football. You know, I guess my focus obviously is, you know, contracts and salary cap and stuff like that. So I suppose off the field, I think it's one of the biggest edges in the sport. And we did, there was an article that came out about the Panthers. It was one example where their analytics, you know, director had kind of a, you know, an Excel sheet breaking down the, you know, value of the trade packages proposed based on a series of different charts. Kind of like something we do as well. You know, we have the PFF chart that Timo has created that kind of gives you percentages of who's going to win the trade based on, you know, PFF wins above replacement, stuff like that. So, you know, their new front office, their new GM, he traded down four times this draft, and the prior regime had traded down twice in a decade before that. So, you know, it's one example where even just doing something simple as just making a move, even if it still adheres to the Jimmy Johnson values, you know, he added a ton of value, and we'll get into the Panthers trades, you know, a little bit later on.
Yeah, I want to get into some of the specifics. So, you know, coming out of the draft, one of the things we try to do at PFF is to bring different coverage on the PFF draft show. The idea that we can evaluate trades, you don't see that on the major networks, I don't think. I don't watch them anymore. We're live. But on major networks, ESPN or NFL, whoever's covering the draft, it's generally, here are the picks that this team received, here are the picks that that team received. But we have the ability to actually say, you know, in with foresight, not in hindsight, that this is a good or bad or even trade. And then when you see the players picked, you know, we've talked a lot of PFF, Brad, about if you're trading up for a quarterback, it changes the whole dynamic, right? And that, so the Bears going to get a Justin Fields, chances are that's worthwhile, but you have a team like the Giants that obviously benefits from that if they know they're not taking a quarterback. So coming out of the draft, what were some of the good trades, some of the good moves, and how did you stack up a lot of the moves that came out on those 3 days of the draft?
Yeah, so I think you touched on one super important point there as well. Well, I guess two. So first, yeah, this isn't a hindsight analysis. You know, shout out Trey Wingo. You don't need to know what happens with these picks to know if it was a good trade or not. You know right away. We can assess value in the moment. You know, there is a marketplace we can compare to prior trade values. But one, and the second huge point is positional value as well. So, you know, the Bears trading from 20 to 11 for a quarterback is way more justifiable than the Jets, for example, trading from 23 to 14 for a guard. You know, I know the teams were very high on Elijah Vera Tucker, but shout out again, Jason Fitzgerald over the cap. He kind of used our contract numbers to show that, You know, Vera Tucker has to become like a top five guard in the NFL if he wants to justify the trade package and kind of make that a, you know, even sum trade package. Whereas, you know, Fields could become an average quarterback and it would still be, okay, this is totally worth it. Yes, the Bears give up a future first round pick, but, you know, they may have landed their franchise quarterback. So that being said, you know, the first trade that we have at kind of the, you know, the best value of the day was the Giants making that trade, trading from 11 down to 20 with Chicago. They then took on their fifth and then a future first and a future fourth. The one, you know, important point is future picks are always standardized. We don't try to guess, you know, this team's going to be picking, you know, 10th or they're going to be picking 30th, whatever. I guess maybe if you were trading with the Patriots or the Browns the last decade, maybe you would kind of adjust it on your chart a little bit. But we just standardized those, treat it as the middle pick in the following round. But regardless, I mean, the Bears, they could be good. They could make the playoffs as they had the last couple of years. They could also be pretty bad. I think it's fair to wonder if the Giants may have landed a top 10 pick in that trade in 2022. So that's definitely, you know, that one jumps off the page as a really strong trade right there.
Yeah, that trade, again, just to reiterate, now you can – you could probably make the point, you know, we talk a lot of PFF here, until you have that quarterback and you know you keep taking shots and the whole thing. I'm going to put aside the point that everybody should have taken Justin Fields, right? Until you know you've got the guy, everybody should just take Justin Fields and see. Assuming the Giants are still trying to build around Daniel Jones, which is fine, it's a no-brainer. It's an absolute no-brainer, and I think some of the stuff that you see and some of the reports you even have coming out and some of the things I've listened to, I try to listen to a bunch of the press conferences when these guys are selected, and say that, yeah, I'll talk about the Jets in a second, but you have a lot of teams that are like, all right, I've got my players. I've got my four players that I want or my three players that I want, and they just hate trading down if one of their favorite players is on the board, and it's really tough. It's really tough to separate yourself from the player that you've been evaluating for a year or sometimes more, and you've interviewed him and you love him and you see the fit and you visualize this best case scenario. So I assume the Giants, you know, maybe the Giants love Devontae Smith and they never would have done this if they didn't, you know, lose him at 10, so to speak. And that would be a mistake. I mean, if the Giants sat there and turned down this trade because they loved Devontae Smith, we love Devontae Smith, it'd be a huge mistake. Because of all the extra value that you said, Devontae Smith would have to be the same value as pick 20 plus next year's first round or wherever that landed, as you said, plus the other picks that they got. And it's just so difficult for a non-quarterback to create that type of value.
100%, 100%. And it does seem like that was their target. You know, as soon as the Eagles jumped them with division rival Cowboys, I thought it was kind of funny that it was three straight NFC East teams at 10, 11, and 12. But yeah, I think as soon as they got jumped for Devontae Smith, they then were smartly, and credit to our, you know, one of our new favorite GMs, Dave Gettleman, who made his first trade down of his career at that moment. But all jokes aside, it was smart. They still got a receiver that I think it kind of got panned a bit at first, in Kadarius Toney out of Florida at 20. But then even Urban Meyer himself came out and was like, yeah, we were hoping we'd get him at 25. So obviously other teams felt similarly about Kadarius Toney, and they land these future picks. So I think that was a great value there. And like you said, there's no guarantee Devontae Smith is going to be that good. We think he's going to be, you know, a very good player. He obviously tested off the charts, you know, or graded off the charts, and produced, you know, at a level at a Heisman level, we don't see, you know, very often, but you know, it's still good value for the Giants there. So that was, I think it was a win-win for both teams, but still have to recognize the Giants did very well there.
All right, couple trades. I want to skip to the Jets and Vikings thing because I really think, again, take the Justin Fields discussion out of this for a second for the Vikings, because supposedly they were in on Justin Fields. They were considering him, but not enough to go make a move to get him. And that's, they at least have Kirk Cousins to fall back on who's graded well and he can move the ball and the whole thing. The Bears are in a different situation, right? Their regime is in a desperate spot. You mentioned if Justin Fields is average, he's worth it. But like for the Bears, they haven't had average quarterback play in forever. So it's even more worth it for the Bears. So take Justin Fields out of it for the Vikings. The fact that they have an offensive line that they needed to overhaul, and they had a Christian Darrisaw on the board, and take our evaluation out of it too. The fact that we would have taken Darrisaw at 13 or 14, we would have done that in a heartbeat. But the Vikings trading to 23, getting Darrisaw, then picking up two third-rounders. Yes, they threw back a fourth at the Jets. But then they get Wyatt Davis, who is the number two guard on our board. They get a free lottery ticket on Kellen Mond in the third round. Any quarterback lottery ticket is just that, and it's a worthwhile shot. And they gave back a fourth rounder to the Jets. To me, if I'm the Jets, I would rather have the Vikings haul in that mix there. But the Jets came out, I listened to their press conference too. They said, we had Elijah Vera Tucker as a top 10 player in this draft. And they might be right, you know, and that's fine. But to your point, Vera Tucker's got to be a top five guard to justify this. And what is the difference between Vera Tucker? To me, Vera Tucker has to be more valuable than Christian Darrisaw and Wyatt Davis, two potential starters, two starters on the Vikings offensive line. That the Jets could use because they have holes all across their line other than left tackle. That's where I just think the Vikings completely win this trade. And the Jets have done a ton of other good things. This is just the one move this offseason essentially I've disagreed with.
100%. I do like their offseason overall. And Joe Douglas also is a good – he's only two drafts in, but he tends to trade down more than he trades up. He gets good value, you know, stuff like that. But, yeah, I agree. I mean – Christian Darrisaw and Wyatt Davis versus Elijah Vera Tucker. It's just impossible. Again, so ignore the picks, just the players that were taken with the picks. It's going to be nearly impossible for Vera Tucker to kind of beat, you know, beat out those two guys just based on the odds. It's not very likely. And who knows, maybe he does kick out to right tackle opposite Mekhi Becton or something like that. It sounds like left guard is probably the plan, but it's going to be a tough one. And like, yeah, that's what the Vikings do. That's what Rick Spielman has done his entire career. And I think underrated too is you get the flyer on Kellen Mond. You know, the Vikings didn't have a pick in that range because they traded for Yannick Ngakoue. They sent their second last year to Jacksonville. And then they did get a third back from Baltimore, but it was pick 90. So they kind of had a gap in their picks there. And they were able to get number 66, get Kellen Mond, probably light a fire under Kirk Cousins a little bit. Also give them some leverage going forward, you know, in extension talks after this upcoming season, stuff like that. And get Wyatt Davis, who we really like out of Ohio State. So that was a slam dunk for the Vikings there.
So in defense of the Jets, pick aside, because we've talked about positional value, they drafted a guard who maybe could play a little tackle. Fine. I've made the statement, if you do a good enough job accumulating picks, as the Jets have done, if you do a good enough job, as the Dolphins have done, accumulating picks over the last 3 years, where do you stand as far as picking your spots on the trade up? I look at it like diversifying your portfolio, right? You've got some safe. The trading down is the safe play. All you're doing is playing the odds and saying three players are more valuable than one or two players are more valuable than one. But every now and again, you got to go full Doge, Brad, right? You got to go, Doge is going to take you to the moon, right? So Vera Tucker is going to take you to the moon, or Jaylen Waddle, as you know, the Dolphins traded back up from 12 to 6. They're going for that moon landing at wide receiver. Where do you stand as far as teams that have drafted 10 or 11 times, you know, multiple years in a row, then taking those shots on single, you know, individual players?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I don't think this is probably the consensus among, you know, people, I guess, you know, that analyze like I do. But I agree with you because eventually, you know, yes, you want as many dart throws as possible. But look, the Jets have two firsts, two seconds, two fourths next year, I believe. So, like, yeah, they're going to still have a lot of premium picks. They're probably still going to be picking relatively high, you know, next offseason. So, yeah, so you can maybe take a shot. Hopefully he is, you know, and like I said, a lot of teams apparently were like, really, really high on Elijah Vera Tucker. So they didn't do it for, you know, Alex Leatherwood. They did it for a guy that everyone seems to really like. We're looking at the other package in Minnesota. It looks great. But yes, the Jets, in my opinion, I agree with you. It's more justifiable when you still have, you know, a ton of capital. Like you said, just like Miami trading back to 6 from 12, you know, people didn't like that move at all either. And they, again, have multiple firsts, multiple set, you know, all these picks. So I think it's definitely, you know, you can get away with it and if you still have a lot to fall back on.
Here's a stupid question, right? If you do trade down a lot and you build through the draft and you do a great job, is there a tipping point where you have too many good players all up at the same time? So say the 2017 Saints had five legitimate players. Trey Hendrickson, they just lost. But again, Ryan Ramczyk at tackle and Marshawn Lattimore at corner and Alvin Kamara and Marcus Williams at safety. They have all those guys back. Trey Hendrickson, they just lost in free agency. Is there a tipping point? If the Saints had drafted like that every year, how difficult is that financially to keep that group together? This is a good problem to have. And are the Saints somewhat justified? Do they look at this and say, look, we just added so much in 2017, so much talent in one draft, they made a crazy trade to trade up for Marcus Davenport, which on paper is never going to pay off. It's never going to work. But is that part of their reasoning? Can you have too many good players in the draft over time financially, or is this a ridiculous notion that I'm bringing up here?
I wouldn't call it ridiculous, but I think it's like you said, it's a good problem to have where you're never worried if you hit on a ton of draft picks. But I mean, I guess if you look at right now, Lattimore and Ramczyk are both on fifth-year options going into this year for, $10-plus million. And then Marcus Williams is on 11.2 or something like that franchise tag. So they have three guys with, $10 million-plus cap hits. And as we all know, their cap situation is super dire. And the funny thing is, I actually think it's going to be more difficult to navigate next offseason than it was this offseason. And they were $100 million over the cap coming into the – coming into free agency. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a component of that as well. But I think at the end of the day, you would say, look, play the compensatory pick game. They'll get a nice one for Trey Hendrickson. And this year, I think, the reason they were bullish again and looking to trade up apparently again was because they got a third round compensatory pick for Teddy Bridgewater, which, fell on their lap and was a blessing from division rival Carolina. One of the stranger signings of the offseason. And they got two third-round compensatory picks for Terry Fontenot, the new GM of the Falcons, signing with Atlanta. So they kind of had – teams definitely view comp picks and picks they get in trades as kind of like a – it's house money. They kind of view it as, these aren't the picks that we earned, in each round based on our record. And they're way more willing to kind of expend with those. And the Saints obviously are one of those clubs.
Yeah, that's an interesting topic. I saw our guy Timo talking about that on Twitter earlier today and how teams it may have actually been the Jets through one of their comp picks. Maybe it wasn't a comp pick, but they threw some extra pick into a deal because it felt like a bonus, it was the one they got from the Jamal Adams trade right through with Seattle. So it felt like a bonus instead of valuing it as the same pick that you were allotted, so to speak. We talked about the Fields trade, the Vera Tucker trade. Any other trades that stood out on the positive end for you in the draft as far as teams just doing a good job as far as the trade down or a trade up?
Yeah, I got to shout this one out. I didn't even realize how good it was until I just went and looked at, preparing for today. It's the Carolina Panthers trading down with the Houston Texans. So the Texans traded up to 89 to take Michigan wide receiver Nico Collins. Again, I think a player that PFF and a lot of people are high on. This class was great at wide receiver, but a lot of smaller guys, a lot of guys that project to be slots. I mean, Collins is a big 6'4", and all of 6'4", he's a big dude. But Carolina got an absolute haul. So they got 109, 158, and a future fourth from Houston. That future fourth could be, a top five pick in the fourth round, based on how bad Houston projects to be. But to break this down, not too nerdy and numbery, essentially, if you just take the total sum of the trade package for both sides, so you say, all right, pick 89 is worth, let's say, 500 points, and then you add up all, 109, 158, and the future fourth, even while devaluing that future pick by a round, Carolina got the third best package, based on percentages in the last decade, since 2011, so 11 years, actually. So it's an absolute monster haul. It's only beaten by, I tweeted out, seeing if someone would guess it. They have not yet. I'll break it on here. So Tyler Lockett actually was the most expensive trade up since 2011. Seattle, kind of surprising, known as a trade down team. They sent four picks to Washington to trade up in the third and take Tyler Lockett. It was a phenomenal, phenomenal trade value for Carolina.
And Lockett was at least worth it, but that is crazy for Seattle. That's unbelievable. I didn't realize that either as far as the Panthers and how good of a trade that is for them. I want to talk about the Texans in a second. Where was the Davenport trade, though? Because that was the most aggressive trade up for a non-QB, right? Or did that mesh within your system as is that how you would describe it for a non-quarterback, the Davenport deal?
So Davenport's definitely way up there. I mean, you're giving a future first and obviously that year's first and another pick. I don't know off the top of my head, but there was another pick as well, I believe, to go up to 14, where Green Bay was. Definitely way up there. But when you break it down percentage-wise, it's not going to be as high because, those pick values are still very high for both sides. The reason why this one kind of jumps off the charts is because it's in the, late third round. And Lockett was third round as well. But just in terms of, total sum given up for a non-quarterback, Davenport's definitely way up there.
And so the Texans, who have they have no depth. However, they've added a lot of depth players. I mean, the Texans' third string can go up against any other team's third string right now. The problem is their first and second string just isn't all that good. So the Texans have added a ton of second and third stringers this offseason. So I don't want to say that their depth is bad, but their roster's not good. And they have not had draft picks over the last couple of years. I can't believe the Texans making this trade from the other side of the coin. And, you know, even if Nico Collins ends up like a Tyler Lockett, I still don't know if it's worth three players, as they just gave up, as you said.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think they did look at the offseason holistically, and that they signed literally, I think it is a record now, they signed like 36 players, which is the most I've seen in like a decade. It's actually insane. But as you mentioned, all these guys are like $2 million, one-year, $2 million signings. You know, their third string is great, but I think it's their second string. It's just everybody else's third string. But yeah, so they kind of drafted and approached the draft as though they kind of could then afford to go quality over quantity. Obviously, their first pick wasn't until the third round because Miami still had their first and second from the Laremy Tunsil trade. But yeah, no, Nick Caserio, he better hope Nico Collins works out, because otherwise he had one of the worst first drafts in terms of understanding value I frankly have ever seen. I think if you didn't give up a future pick, I would not have said that prior sentence. But to give future capital when, like you said, you just had to deal with that, and that future pick is going to be probably going to be a very high pick. You just can't do that if you're in Houston's position.
He's also coming out of a draft room in New England that has been understanding this for 20 years. They've understood this better than any team trading down. I mean, there has never been more angst in a city than, or you know, in a region than New England when they trade down out of the first round, like every single season. And their fans are like, give me the star player. Give me this. You know, I want the big name on the board. And they're just like, no, we're getting three players for the price of one. We're getting next year's second rounder for this year's third rounder. I mean, they worked it better than anybody. And it is fascinating to me that Caserio went kind of the cheap route in free agency, which is fine, but I don't know who he signed that's on that roster in 3 years from now when they're probably coming out of it, you know? So that's my concern with the Texans and what they're doing this offseason. But interesting that it's coming out of New England, man. They're like the trade down kings, and now Caserio's setting records the other way, as New England has a crazy spending spree. I want to touch on the Patriots quick. I didn't give you a heads up to this, but a lot of the guys that they signed this year have massive cap numbers next year. And I keep saying, look, New England got a lot better this year. I think in 2021, they're a lot better. But a year from now, when Matthew Judon and Nelson Agholor and all of these guys, the two tight ends, Jonnu Smith and Hunter Henry, they're all making between $10 and $15 million. Are we going to be looking at their situation a year from now saying they're paying a whole bunch of average to pretty good players a huge chunk of money? Or are they anticipating something with the salary cap where this won't look as egregious in coming years? Am I reading this right, that I think New England's much better this year, cap situation's fine, but next year I feel like they're going to be overpaying a slew of players that aren't going to feel all that exciting compared to the rest of the free agent crop?
Oh, I completely agree with you, and I think it was overlooked. It always is, but kind of in free agency when we were kind of panning their approach and, you know, spending a lot of money on average players, which is essentially what free agency is people always responding, oh, well, his cap hit in 2021 is only $4 million. Like, yeah, look, you can manipulate the cap however, you know, all you want. Everybody can do that. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the odds, Nelson Agholor, if he doesn't have a really good season, they'll probably move on from him. The guarantees are heavily front-loaded there, so, you know, he'll be gone by then. But, yeah, I mean, Judon and the tight ends, those are two-year contracts at minimum. I think – their justification now, obviously this is hindsight analysis of the highest order, but now they'll probably tell themselves, look, we have a rookie quarterback that we want to have in a good situation. Mac Jones will have a really good offensive line, and at least we'll have the safety nets of, you know, two solid tight ends in the passing game. You know, the receiving core could get better, but, you know, he'll still have that to work with. So it makes sense because it'll help ease his transition and you know, he'll be safe back there and won't get killed, and we'll have kind of some outlets. So that'll be their justification, and they're still fine cap-wise, even though they spent, you know, the most total guaranteed money of all time in an offseason. But I do not think it's going to age very well, especially if Cam and Mac Jones aren't good, then it's going to be just all for naught.
I did think that that was part of their reasoning, because they either have Cam Newton essentially on a rookie contract, or, you know, a backup type of quarterback contract, or they have a rookie. So I think they did feel, hey, we can overpay and play this game. You know, they haven't had that luxury for a while, despite however you want to break down Tom's, you know, cap savings and the whole thing. It's not like he was a rookie contract quarterback for the last 10 to 15 years, right?
No, that gets overblown. He was never like the highest paid quarterback. He was always like top seven. That whole
thing's overblown, right?
Totally overblown. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
He's still the guy, as we saw in Tampa Bay. He's the reason for all of the success, at least in the last 10 years, I'd say. All right, let's get into some of the best offseason. Unless you have any other good trade stories from this year, or because I thought the Panthers anecdote was incredible, the fact that it was that bad. Are that good for the Panthers, that bad for the Texans? I want to get into some of the best off seasons from start to finish, free agency, the draft. Who are some of your favorite teams that that you've liked this offseason?
Yeah, so, you know, I think for me, the draft honestly bolstered a lot of these, which was cool to see. So the Browns, the football team of Washington, and every time I say that, I have to, like, catch myself, and the Chargers, I think were my big three. Both in, you know, overall, you know, I think the Chargers really, you know, I liked how they just aggressively addressed the offensive line. And that already was the case with Corey Linsley at center and Matt Filer kind of as a guard tackle. You know, he kind of can play everywhere. And then obviously that, you know, they hit the home run with Rashawn Slater and the Browns. You know, I think their defense is just, everyone talks about the big names, but I think the thing with them too is if they have a slew of injuries again, they're now extremely deep on defense as well. And then lastly, you know, football team just really kind of bolstered all their spots. They might have the best defense in the NFL this year. So I know you didn't ask for analysis, but those are just kind of my high level reasons why those are my top three.
No, I want analysis too. I want to discuss this because it look, we don't all agree at PFF about everything, but sometimes because you come at analysis a little different from the way I do it, from the way other people on the R&D do it, from even the way Sam does it, but we've all come to the same conclusion. Chargers, Browns, football team, Jets, I mean, a lot of, they're liking a lot of what these teams have done from free agency to the draft. So I agree with a whole bunch of that. I think the Browns in particular are making just so many smart moves. We've highlighted this a ton on the podcast, but it's fun to see them kind of, It's not copying PFF's theories or anything like that, or using them, so to speak, but they're coming to a lot of the same conclusions we are, and they've added so much coverage depth. And so the funny thing is, too, they could have easily said, we're never going to – like the Chiefs – I want to talk about the Chiefs in a second, but the Chiefs said, we're never again going to have a game with a bad offensive line, so we're going to attack the offensive line. Remember the Browns had a game last year. Their top four wideouts were all hurt and the whole thing, and – I feel like they didn't overreact to that, to the receiver thing, but the coverage thing, having four corners and three to four safeties and four linebackers, that's not an overreaction. That's just a team building strategy. Like, that's the way to do it, because you want versatility and you need depth on that side just so you don't fall apart. And that's where the Browns did have an issue last year. So I like the fact that they didn't necessarily overreact to like that one game where they didn't have any receivers, but they just said from a team building standpoint, we have to have depth in the secondary because in part we do need to beat the Chiefs every year if we want to try to win in the AFC.
100%. I think the overreaction to the prior season is a huge thing we saw. Yeah, we'll get into the Chiefs for sure. But yeah, I think that you mentioned kind of how I maybe view things a bit differently. Not that other folks at PFF don't view things this way, but for me in free agency and the draft after kind of the first two rounds, like, depth stands out to me more than these big flashy names. Yes, the big flashy names can work out more often than not. On a value perspective, it's not going to work out. But like for me, guys like Malik Jackson on the interior, no one's talking about. Tack McKinley on the edge now, you know, as you know, especially after they add Clowney, you know, McKinley now is kind of, you know, a depth piece there as well. And like you mentioned, they have, I mean, 2 second rounders out of a, you know, really good LSU team. Grant Delpit and Greedy Williams, you know, might not even start next year, and are really good, you know, secondary players. So, and then the wide receiver thing too, I think I loved the Anthony Schwartz pick. I thought maybe it was a little bit early, but I liked they didn't overreact. And they didn't go for, you know, I think teams probably thought, or people probably thought they needed like maybe another outside guy. You know, Odell's there, but he's kind of coming off the injury, stuff like that. Donovan Peoples-Jones has shown some flashes, but, you know, we don't know there yet. I love the Schwartz pick because I think he's going to be more of a weapon in the run game, not necessarily getting the ball, But I think he's going to run jet sweep like 1,000 times because he's a track star. He, you know, he's a speed guy. And I think Stefanski's going to have him in motion pre-snap every time he's on the field. And it's just going to add another element to their run game. So I agree. I think they just built smart, you know, no matter how you look at it.
Yeah, you have to account for speed no matter what when they're on the field, even if he can't catch the ball. So Schwartz, any hope he develops as a receiver becomes more than that. The Tack McKinley move that you mentioned, I wrote before the season, the Falcons didn't pick up his fifth-year option. But, you know, so he hit free agency. I said, look, you just have to separate first-round bust versus what a guy is. Tack McKinley's a solid, very low-end number two pass rusher. He's a number three pass rusher. If he's your number three, you're good. That's what the Browns have done because they have Myles Garrett. They added Jadeveon Clowney. So that's where you get value out of that former first-rounder. I think too many teams think, well, I had a first-round grade on him 4 years ago. I'm going to get the most out of him. He's still a first-rounder. He still has that potential. If the Browns rolled in and thought that or made him a starter with the anticipation of first-round production, that'd be the mistake. But you push him to the number three pass rusher, it's like, all right, now we've got – that's a value play there. So with the Chiefs, I've argued with Sam about this a little bit, and he's not here. So I can do whatever I want with no Sam. There's an empty seat over here next to me. The Chiefs, I think, have completely overreacted to their offensive line situation. And it's not so much that they don't want to have a bad offensive line ever. I get it. We always use the phrase creep back toward average here on the PFF NFL podcast. It's not a bad thing to have a top 10 offensive line. I'm just looking at the investment that they've made there. The Orlando Brown trade, first round pick, plus they're going to, I'll ask you a couple things. What are they going to have to pay Orlando Brown? How is their cap situation going to look going forward with Orlando Brown and Joe Tooney on the left side, figuring out the rest of their offensive line? And how will this affect their team building in the coming years? Do they have enough flexibility that they can handle Tooney and Orlando Brown making a ton of money, that they could still attack receiver if they need to, secondary if they need to? What are your thoughts on the Chiefs, the O-line, Orlando Brown, and just their prospects building around Mahomes going forward?
It gets right to what you just said, where it's about value, not just about, you know, like improving the football team. Like, yes, their offensive line will be good. They're not going to have a Buccaneers situation again. But, I mean, you make Tooney the highest paid guard in football by a decent margin. You know, I actually think compared to position, I think he's one of the, like, he's more above the second guy than I think any other position in football right now. I'm sure, you know, Quentin Nelson will probably top him in the next couple months, but regardless, so you spend a ton on left guard, you then trade, you know, with a good AFC team in the Ravens. I thought this was funny. This is classic, you know, getting back to the Jimmy Johnson thing, but they told themselves they wanted to give an equivalent of a second round pick to Baltimore for Orlando Brown. So instead of just giving 31, they added a bunch of other picks and kind of made it a whole package. Based on the PFF chart, they actually ended up giving them a package equivalent to pick number 27 instead of just giving them number 31. So they kind of, you know, they used an old outdated chart and actually ended up giving more depending how you look at it. But so the leverage that Brown has now as getting, you know, traded for a first round pick, you know, very good player, going to play left tackle, of course. He's going to ask for $20 million plus per year. And he's gonna get it. I mean, they don't have a choice. That's how this leverage works, unless he's terrible, which is not gonna happen. So he'll get a massive deal. And what that's gonna do is they're just so top heavy now. You know, they have so many players in these huge deals. And I think people are underestimating. Tight end falls off very fast. There could be two seasons of Travis Kelce, maybe even one. And then he's kind of not worth what he's getting paid or just isn't producing at the, you know, insane level he is right now. And then you have Tyrann Mathieu is going to the final year of his deal. Will want to become the highest paid safety in the NFL, deserves it for sure. Tyreek Hill has 2 years left. We already know he wants new money. He kind of rejected a restructure. Won't get into the specifics, but he kind of rejected a restructure because he wants a new contract instead. And he'll ask for 20 plus million, you know, in his own right. And so it just makes things tougher. Yes, they'll continue to play the cap manipulation game. And if the cap jumps up, maybe this soundbite will sound stupid because it won't matter, but it just makes things harder. And you're not going to, like you talk about, it's going to be harder to add depth. I mean, look, they missed out on Juju Smith-Schuster. They missed out on a bunch of these kind of, you know, depth pieces they wanted and tertiary receivers they wanted, because I don't think they could offer as much as other teams. And no, I'm not saying you shouldn't, you know, get a good left tackle at the expense of Juju Smith-Schuster, but like these little components and these little deals matter. And it kind of adds up in the aggregate. So they're like the Rams this point, where they're going to have 7-8 players taking up, you know, 75% of the cap. If they stay healthy, then, you know, and they have good coaching as they do, then maybe it won't matter. But I mean, you get a couple of key injuries and you might wipe out kind of a playoff run. So it's an interesting and bold strategy for Kansas City when we saw New England do the opposite. And the reason why they were able to sustain a dynasty for 20 years is because they did the exact opposite.
See, that's the comparison I always make. It's this, I mean, this isn't rocket science to me, but it's like, okay, the Chiefs are the next dynasty, right? They're the next team that divisional round, right? They're in the divisional round next year. They're almost certainly in the conference championship. I think that is fair. But that was New England for 20 years of a dynasty. And the few times that New England failed is when they failed to support Tom Brady from a weapon standpoint, or when the defense maybe like completely fell apart. 2011, they made it to the Super Bowl and they had receivers playing safety and slot corner, and they completely fell apart from a depth standpoint. But you also never really looked at New England's roster other than when they had Gronk, right? Like, they never really had stars. They never really had massive stars. You could argue a Richard Seymour. You could argue some of the bigger name players, you know, early in the dynasty of Rodney Harrison and stuff like that. But my concern with the Chiefs is their stars do matter. Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce. I mean, to me, it's Mahomes, obviously. But I've never seen Mahomes without Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce. And I don't want to see that. I don't want to see the world where Mahomes, using the Brady equivalent, Mahomes has to drag Jabbar Gaffney and Rashay Caldwell to the Super Bowl, right? Or has to drag Kenbrell Tompkins and Aaron Dobson and Julian Edelman in a banged-up Gronk, right? I mean, like, I don't think the Chiefs want to see that world. So I guess, am I fair in saying there, if Tyreek can't get paid, or if Travis Kelce falls off a little bit, the Chiefs are hurting their ability to just keep the playmakers intact. The playmakers ultimately are more important than the offensive line, as long as the offensive line's above a certain baseline. And now they're going to be way above that baseline and paying for it. I just don't know if they're going to be able to support him from a playmaker standpoint in the coming years.
No, I agree 100%. And that's the thing is, like, yes, like we do think that he'll be able to make it work with kind of maybe not the best receiving core ever. But like you said, we haven't seen that yet. I'm sure he will, but he can't have bad weapons. I mean, eventually you need guys to make plays, you know, in big games. And again, to go to the Patriots analogy, I think the thing with them too is they're also kind of making the mistake where they're paying for the premium positions too. So, like, yes, the Patriots made Stephon Gilmore one of the highest paid corners in the NFL, but corner was one of the lowest paid positions in the league. So that's different than, you know, paying a left tackle, trading a first and paying Frank Clark. Like, those are different things than paying for safeties and corners and you know, stuff the Patriots were doing. So they're kind of just falling for some of these holes where it just kind of shortens the window. Are they more likely to win the next 2 years? Yes. But are they then less likely to continue to sustain that? Also, yes.
Yeah, I just think it's – look, Mahomes is awesome. He's locked up for the 10 years. I think that's just going to be one of the most fun stories to follow, though, is just how Kansas City builds around him in the coming years. So really quick, you mentioned the Rams. And as we were talking about this, I wanted to get your take on their strategy. I mean, they've essentially said, if we're picking in the 20s, we'd rather have a player. Now, granted, they've traded multiple first-rounders for Jalen Ramsey, multiple first-rounders for Matthew Stafford. Where do you stand on the Rams' strategy of not even drafting in the first round since Jared Goff in 2016, and the idea that you'd rather have a player rather than the pick, and how does that affect them financially as well?
Yeah, you know, it goes back to what we discussed before, kind of with the Jets and Dolphins, is that I think people don't realize Les Snead in LA is actually one of the trade down kings as well. The guy trades down like crazy. So he does stockpile. He does accumulate a lot of capital outside of the first round. And they do tend to, you know, scout well and hit on some of these kind of third to fifth round players. So that is part of it. That is a component. But, you know, overall, it's a dangerous game. I mean, I think we even saw, you know, last year, yes, they had a quarterback injury, but Aaron Donald goes out for the playoff game. And their defense kind of got gashed. Like, they are, you know, they're top heavy. And so even with, you know, they had John Johnson, Jalen Ramsey, Troy Hill, all these great players, Darius Williams, like, they're still kind of a point where one or two injuries can derail them more than other clubs, because the depth is just not going to be there. You know, why they pay Leonard Floyd that much money, you know, I frankly don't know. I saw he actually had a lower lower pass rush win percentage, you know, per our charting than he did the year before. Like he just got more sacks and they fell for the sack trick, but it's because he was playing next to Aaron Donald. So the pick thing, it's a dangerous game. I think this final trade for Stafford, I would kind of argue, and this is probably kind of, you know, kind of justification and me kind of, you know, speaking for them and making it positive. At this point, do it because it's quarterback and you have a good roster. You have a quote unquote window, all these things. And you feel as though Jared Goff is the only reason why you're not making the NFC Championship game, you know, year after year. So this one's more justifiable, but they're in the same position where like the margins are thin. Their cap is a mess. You know, it was a mess this offseason. It's going to be tough again next offseason. Donald needs new money and he'll ask for the moon and he deserves the moon. So it's kind of a similar spot where, you know, Stafford better be good and they better at least make, you know, divisional round at the very least. Otherwise it could kind of, again, could be unlike the Chiefs, like it could be all for naught for them where, you know, if it doesn't work out with Stafford and they don't make the next 2 years, they don't make a deep playoff run. I mean, they might be tearing everything down.
Yeah, I agree with a bunch of that. I mean, look, Jalen Ramsey's a star. If you're gonna trade multiple first rounders, at least it's a Jalen Ramsey. At least it's in Stafford. I do think Stafford is an upgrade over Jared Goff, and I can't wait to see Stafford in Sean McVay's offense. We haven't seen that. You know, we've only really seen McVay with Jared Goff, who's been fine. He's elevated Goff and done a good job. So, I don't have a strong opinion either way, other than I do think it's risky. I mean, that's it. It doesn't mean it can't pay off. I think it puts so much pressure on those middle round picks, and trading down is the way to offset that. At the very least, the difference with the Rams and the Texans, after they traded up for Deshaun Watson, also traded away all their picks. And you just can't build a team like that. You just can't do it. At least the Rams offset trading first rounders by trading down and accumulating draft picks and more lottery tickets. And that's the balance. The strategy works well together, but it does put a lot of pressure on their scouts and their evaluation and coming up with hitting on third rounders, hitting on more Cooper Kupps and, you know, players like that in the middle round. So
it also puts a ton of pressure on like specific units. Like their offensive line could be one of the worst in football next year, for all we know. I mean, Andrew Whitworth at 40 years old is the best guy on the line. So you take the risk of one unit could kind of bring everything down. So yeah, just wanted to quickly throw that in there too.
It's good. And that's what happened 2 years ago, you know, and then they bet on the youth. They were bad in 2019. They bet on the youth in 2020, and it did work, youth outside of Whitworth, and it did work better last year. They were much better, but you know, it's a good point. You're more fragile across the roster when you don't have as much depth. So the one last thing, the few times where I've been critical of teams, and I'm not a draft for need type of guy, but there's a team like the Colts who definitely have a left tackle need, and I think need to load up on receivers for Carson Wentz, or the Titans wide receiver two situation with Corey Davis gone and no real clear replacement opposite AJ Brown. So there's a few teams that have very specific needs. You could say the Jets' entire cornerback room, whatever it is. And then the Ravens doing a nice job getting my guy Alejandro Villanueva after the draft. So discuss this rule as far as compensatory picks, signing free agents after the draft, and where teams can still work, because the offseason's not over after the draft. There's still a lot of players available. There's guys that are going to be cut. How does this rule work? And how is a team like the Ravens really exploit that and pull in Alejandro Villanueva and not affect their future comp picks?
Yeah, so this has always been a rule, but the date actually got updated in the latest CBA. This is kind of a win for the veterans in this latest negotiation, one of the rare, you know, few and far between wins the players got in this CBA. But essentially, the compensatory formula, you know, there's players that are considered compensatory free agents, meaning they, you know, signed for a certain amount of money. They were unrestricted free agents coming into the offseason. And essentially, the formula works where the first point is just net UFAs signed versus net UFAs lost. On May 3rd, the players no longer counted. So Alejandro Villanueva would have been a compensatory free agent. He would have counted against the Ravens. You know, it could have canceled out potentially, you know, an Ngakoue or a Matthew Judon. But because they waited until after the deadline, he now no longer counts in the formula at all. So what that means is there's some veterans out there that I think teams are now going to make moves on. We saw Casey Hayward sign with the Raiders, you know, a couple days after as well. And essentially it just means that teams now don't have to worry about that. So teams, and a lot of teams do care about that. The Ravens have had the most comp picks of any franchise in the NFL since they were, you know, enacted in 94. So they obviously care a ton. There was even a couple of years ago, a quote from a free agent where it was like, yeah, the Ravens told me to call them back in June. You know, like once the deadline passed, like they told him to his face, like, yeah, we like you a lot. We're just not interested in signing you until, you know, X date. So it kind of means free for all. Every signing no longer has a negative penalty associated with it. And yeah, I mean, there's some good players left. I mean, Richard Sherman, obviously out there. I think some good offensive line help, like a Mitchell Schwartz and Eric Fisher or Russell Okung. And then I think you mentioned the Jets, and their corner room is scary how bad it is. And they did draft three of them, but all kind of later round guys. And the whole corner room is just a bunch of day three guys from like 2019 to now.
It's literally all fifth and sixth round picks.
Former Jet could be big for them. Oh, go ahead.
I was just saying it literally is all fifth and sixth round picks for the Jets. That is, it's like seven of them. Yeah.
Yeah, it's wild. And then, yeah, like, some edge rushers too. Melvin Ingram, Justin Houston. Like, there's some good players out there. So their market is now reopened.
Yeah, so it's still a story. So there's still more to cover. The draft doesn't fill every need. So even if I'm critical of teams for not, you know, addressing needs, there's still more work to be done. So it's good to understand, you know, the change in the rule and change of the date and all that stuff, because we can still see a lot of signings here throughout the month of May and into June. So anyway, Brad, thank you for joining me. I needed some help with no Sam here, and it was good to get your off-season thoughts. And you guys can check out all of Brad's work over at pff.com. We have our author pages. You can check out all of everything Brad has written over at pff.com. Thanks, man.
Thank you, man. Yeah, the average height of the podcast went up about, I don't know, 7-8 inches.
Yeah, we'll have to have you on more regularly too, because Sam gets intimidated by height and the whole deal. So it'll be good. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thanks to Brad for joining the show. I love that discussion. He's just added a whole lot to PFF as far as contract discussion and understanding the big picture. I thought our free agent coverage was just different from previous years, because it wasn't just about 2021. It was about how are these contracts going to affect things going forward. How did 22, 23, and 24 get affected? So between that and the draft trades, and it just adding a whole different perspective here at PFF. So appreciate Brad for joining me and helping me through now that, you know, I'm sitting here next to nobody. But I got the mic, so I get full control here. I do first want to remind you guys that our newest sponsor at the PFF NFL podcast is Sweat Tailor, premium menswear brand defining a new kind of casual. From jackets and pants to joggers and hoodies, Sweat Tailor's designs are made to seamlessly fit into your life, whether you're going from the office to drinks to wherever the night takes you. Specializing in athleisure wear for men, pieces are designed with comfort and versatility in mind for every day. You can use the promo code PFF-SWEAT, PFF-SWET. For 25% off, that's PFF-SWEAT, S-W-E-T, for 25% off your order at sweattailor.com. So, since I have the mic, I can't get interrupted. I can go for 5 hours if I want here. I don't know. Do I go minor league baseball stories? Do we go mid-90s Jaguars? I don't even know where to go. But again, I figured it'd be good to add a little optimism to your offseason. So we've been here breaking down free agency, the draft. I keep wanting to turn to Sam and talk to him, but I have you guys. I have your full attention here with the Steve podcast, PFF NFL Steve podcast. The offseason, sometimes we're critical of free agent moves. Sometimes we're critical of draft classes. I'm sorry, Raiders and Steelers fans. You know, sometimes we're a little bit too negative. So I'm going to flip the script here today, and we're going to go team by team, and I'm going to give you one reason for optimism for each team in the NFL, right? So everybody can be happy here, and you know, we don't need Sam for this. He'll be dragging us down. He'll be telling us about all your worst moves. So let's go through it. We're going to give you a reason for optimism for each team. We're going to start in the AFC East, the Buffalo Bills, and a lot of this will be repeating things that we've said, because we love a lot of what the Bills have done. One of the best rosters in the NFL, Josh Allen, heading into year four. He was elite last year. He's only going to get better. Josh Allen's incredible. He's got a cannon for an arm. He has that running threat. His accuracy has improved. Bills fans should be really excited. and you got all the receivers that you need. They've built the offense the way you're supposed to build around a young quarterback. A good offensive line, a great group of playmakers, and Brian Daboll's back and working with Josh Allen. So the Bills, really good. You're in really good shape. Miami Dolphins in the AFC East. Another team, strong roster. And they took one of their weaknesses, which was their playmakers. They add Will Fuller. They add Jaylen Waddle. You've got speed. Love the way they've built their secondary. Love the way they've built it with corner after corner after corner. Different style corners. Guys who could play the man coverage that they like to play. Now they're adding guys like Javon Holland in the second round of the draft. A safety, a corner, a hybrid. Adding a little bit to the defensive line with Jalen Phillips in the first round. So accumulating draft capital, building that roster, the Dolphins, you're in great shape. You're going to have a great season, Dolphins fans. New England Patriots, look at this. So one of the probably the most improved team in the league just for this year, here in 2021. The worst tight end room to maybe the best with Jonnu Smith, with Hunter Henry. You bring back Cam Newton. You got Mac Jones in the first round. You sit at 15 and you still get maybe a future franchise starting quarterback. Bringing in Matthew Judon and Nelson Agholor and Kendrick Bourne and all these free agents, the receivers are much better. The tight ends are much better. They worked the cap the right way for this year. Most improved team in the NFL, New England Patriots. You still have Bill Belichick. So the Patriots, look at the great offseason. You're awesome, Patriots fans. You're going to have a great season. The New York Jets, whole new regime, new excitement. Robert Saleh's in there. Zach Wilson's in there. Can you even believe that they got Elijah Moore at the beginning of the second round? You have Elijah Vera Tucker, so the offensive line's getting better. You got a new offense from the Shanahan tree. We know that always works. And you got new playmakers. So the offensive overhaul, it's going to be the best offense they've had there in New York in years. And you got a guy like Carl Lawson on the defensive line. You're adding to that defensive line, plus Robert Saleh's magic touch on the defensive side of the ball. The Jets turning things around. AFC North, we get the Baltimore Ravens. They're just a good overall team. Working their magic when it comes to roster building, trading Orlando Brown, replacing him with the great Alejandro Villanueva. What a deal. Plus adding Odafe Oweh in the first round. The most athletic, the biggest athletic freak of all edge defenders in the first round. But then you add all the wide receiver help. Sammy Watkins is in. Rashad Bateman is in. So love what the Ravens are doing. You turned a weakness into a potential strength when it comes to the receiving talent. And their secondary is still loaded. So the Ravens, you guys are going to have a great season in Baltimore. Cincinnati Bengals. Joe Burrow, he's the reason for hope. I know he got hurt last year, but you've protected him with the receiver. You've protected him with Ja'Marr Chase and a trio of receivers between Ja'Marr Chase, T. Higgins, and Tyler Boyd. Those guys are going to get open. They're going to get open quickly. They're going to get open to every level of the field. You bring in Jackson Carmen to be a guard first, maybe transition to tackle. You bring in a Riley Reiff, so the offensive line's better. The playmakers are better. And you overhauled the defensive line. So loving what the Bengals are doing. Reason for hope and optimism here in our home city of Cincinnati. Cleveland Browns. This is repeating again. We just talked about it with Brad. But one of the best rosters in the NFL. Good decisions left and right. You've got great decision makers at the top of the organization. They know how to build depth around, across the team. They've got Baker Mayfield, who did turn it around. I was a little skeptical. I was a little nervous early last season. But Baker completely turned it around down the stretch. So the Browns are in great shape going forward. Baker will continue to get better. Best offensive line in the NFL. Browns are just good across the board. And if they have injuries this year, they can handle it. Maybe better than any team in the NFL. Pittsburgh Steelers. You guys haven't had a whole lot of positive energy coming from the PFF NFL podcast recently, but still have one of the best pass rushes in the NFL. You got TJ Watt, Defensive Player of the Year candidate every single year. Devin Bush is coming back to the middle of that defense. The secondary has played above their skill set. You got Minkah Fitzpatrick back there patrolling the middle of the field. You're going to blitz a ton, scheme it up, and put pressure on opposing offenses. We know that's going to happen. I like Chase Claypool. I like Deontay Johnson. I like the playmakers that you have at receiver. And I think even having Najee Harris, even with the first round running back selection, Big Ben's going to throw the ball down the field this year. He's going to throw the ball down the field better than he has over the last few years when he's been healthy. So the Steelers, reason for optimism. Pass game's going to be better. The run game might be better by default. And you got that good defense. So look at that, Pittsburgh Steelers. You guys are going to have a great season as well. AFC South, Houston Texans. Okay, we had to stretch here. But we got a new regime. We got a whole new feel here. It's a new group, new head coach, new general manager. It's starting from the, it's like it's 2002 all over again. Did you have optimism in 2002, Texans fans? It was a new team, and you're starting from scratch, and maybe your expectations were low, but you're looking to the future. You're figuring out which players are going to be a part of this rebuild here in Houston. So you get to maybe not look forward to winning a ton of games this year, but look into the future. So don't fret. The roster's not great overall, but they added a ton of depth players, and we're going to see who is a part of the Houston Texans in 2022 and 23 and beyond. That's what we have to look forward to as a Houston Texans fan. Indianapolis Colts. Look at this. A playoff team, one of the best rosters in the NFL. Carson Wentz is coming back. He's rejuvenated with Frank Reich. You have one of the best offensive lines in the NFL. One of the best overall rosters in the NFL. Darius Leonard in the middle of that defense. They play hard. They get after it. You had Kwity Paye, an incredible story as your first round pick. So the defensive line is going to be better. Secondary solid. Good group of receivers. Michael Pittman's going to break out at receiver this year for Carson Wentz. Colts, back to the playoffs and beyond this year. Reason for optimism. Jacksonville Jaguars. This is easy. Trevor Lawrence. Forget Urban Meyer for a minute. Yeah, be optimistic. You got Trevor, though. Trevor's going to keep you in the mix every single year. He's got playmakers to throw to. You bring in Marvin Jones. Laviska Shenault could still become wide receiver one. You still have DJ Chark. You got a fresh back seven with CJ Henderson coming back off injury. Shaquille Griffin on the back end there. The Jaguars overhauling the roster, but most importantly, you got Trevor Lawrence in the building, and every single year there's reason for optimism because Trevor Lawrence is there. He's got a big arm, athleticism. He'll attack all levels of the field and make decisions, good decisions, while still bringing big-time throws to the table. That's the best combination for quarterbacks. Optimism in Jacksonville. Tennessee Titans. You guys have the dudes back. Ryan Tannehill has been a dude over the last couple of years. 90-plus PFF grade each of the last 2 years. He has rejuvenated his career. A.J. Brown, Derrick Henry, those guys take over games to win at various times during the season. They're back. Caleb Farley could be the dude on the defensive side of the ball. He's that good. He's a top five, top 10 player in this draft if he's healthy. So Farley's freak athleticism and size, it's like having A.J. Brown in your secondary. Bring in Janoris Jenkins as a playmaker too. Pass rush will be a little bit better this year. So I like the Titans. Look at that. Be optimistic in Tennessee because you've got your nucleus back and maybe even more with Caleb Farley and just a good solid overall draft in Tennessee. All right, to the AFC West, Denver Broncos, one of the best rosters in the NFL. I won't even mention Aaron Rodgers. That would put you over the top. But even right now, one of the best wide receiver rooms in the NFL. Cortland Sutton's coming back off an injury. The secondary is incredible. Bringing in Ronald Darby, bringing in Kyle Fuller, bringing in Patrick Surtain. You already have Bryce Callahan, one of the most underrated players in the entire NFL. Von Miller's coming back off injury. Denver is actually building a defense with Vic Fangio that can compete with the Chiefs. They can slow down Mahomes and the Chiefs. So I love what the Broncos are doing. Drew Locke's going to get even better if he has a chance to play. Teddy Bridgewater is going to be that distributor with all those playmakers. The Broncos, be optimistic in Denver. Kansas City Chiefs, of course this is easy. Patrick Mahomes, you have Tyreek Hill, you have Travis Kelce, but never again will you have a game that looks like that Bucs game where the offensive line fell apart. You bring in Orlando Brown, Joe Tooney, Kyle Long out of retirement, drafting Creed Humphrey. This entire offensive line could be one of the best in the NFL. The best one under Mahomes. The best one that Mahomes has played behind. You got those playmakers. You still have Spags on defense. We know that he can make magic with the group that they have there. And Chris Jones on the defensive line, Tyrann Mathieu in the secondary. So they have stars on both sides of the ball. Chiefs, back to the Super Bowl, baby. Go Chiefs. Los Angeles Chargers. Optimism with Justin Herbert. Year two. They completely overhauled the offensive line. They had the number 30 pass-blocking offensive line last year, and Justin Herbert still had a great rookie season. So, yeah, we're optimistic for the Chiefs. Four-fifths of their offensive line is changed, including first-rounder Rashawn Slater. Bring the best center in free agency in Corey Linsley. And then the Chargers steal Asante Samuel in the draft. It looked like the secondary was going to start getting worse, that they were going to, you know, lose pieces after Casey Hayward fell off last year. But Chris Harris is coming back from injury, Asante Samuel, and you got Brandon Staley. Brandon Staley a year ago at this time, nobody knew what Brandon Staley was going to do with the Rams. And all he did was turn them into the best defense in the NFL. a defense that nobody could complete a pass beyond 20 yards. Couldn't complete anything down the field. Think you need that facing the Chiefs in that division? The Chargers are building a team to compete with the Chiefs in the AFC West. All right, Raiders fans, optimism for the Raiders. Derek Carr has been one of the better quarterbacks in the NFL over the last couple of years. That offense was one of the league's best last year. Yeah, they overhauled the offensive line, but we're going to see a breakout from Henry Ruggs this year. You've got Darren Waller. Nobody can cover Darren Waller. He's right up there with that Travis Kelce, maybe Kyle Pitts. Can't cover tight end type of guy, George Kittle. And the Raiders' defense is going to get better, if for nothing else, because you get Gus Bradley coming in. And Gus Bradley is going to simplify the defense. They're going to play that cover three scheme that he brings over through that Seattle tree. And those guys are going to play better. They've built that secondary. They bring in Trevon Merrig in the second round. Alex Leatherwood's going to be a solid starter at some point. But the offensive line will be fine. The offense will be good, but that defense will be better just with the new scheme simplified. Corey Littleton's going to be the free agent that they thought they were getting 2 years ago. The Raiders have reason for optimism, even here on the PFF NFL podcast. How about that? Let's go to the NFC. Starting the NFC East. Dallas Cowboys. Dak is back. And they've got the same situation as the Raiders. A bad defense is going to get better, if for nothing else, because the new system, Dan Quinn's going to come in, simplify things. No more busted coverages. None of that. Middle of the defense is going to be great. Bring in Micah Parsons. You still have Jalen Smith. You have Leighton Vander Esch. Bring in Jabril Cox in the fourth round. Bunch of tough guys on that defensive line that they added in the draft. But most importantly, Dallas has Dak back throwing to one of the best groups of playmakers in the NFL, with Amari Cooper, with Michael Gallup, with CeeDee Lamb. One of the best offensive lines. When they get healthy, Tyron Smith back, Lyle Collins healthy, Connor Williams breaking out last year, Zach Martin, maybe the best guard in the NFL besides Quentin Nelson, right up there with Quentin Nelson. The Cowboys' O-line's good, playmakers, pass game. Cowboys, be optimistic heading into the season. How about the New York Giants? We got reason to be excited there too. Look at this group of playmakers. We keep talking about building a basketball team. They're doing it. Darius Slayton's already there as a deep threat, but they add Kenny Golladay. They add Kadarius Toney. We know Sterling Shepard's already there. You got Eric Ingram. You got Kyle Rudolph in the mix now. You have every type of player. I haven't even added Saquon Barkley to the mix. If he's healthy, how are you going to cover those guys? Daniel Jones played way better than his stats last year, and that's not going to happen this year. He's going to play. If he plays at the same level, he's going to put up big numbers with these guys. And while the offensive line might still need some work, the pieces are there. Andrew Thomas got better. Matt Parrott showed some good stuff last year as a rookie. Nate Solder's coming back. So the offensive line is going to be better. And this defense, look at this defense. Feisty last year, they're going to be legit this year. One of the best secondaries in the NFL. Love what the Giants are doing on the defensive side of the ball. So there's a reason to be excited for year three of Daniel Jones in New York. Philadelphia Eagles. A lot of your excitement might be forward-looking, but you get to see, is Jalen Hurts the next franchise quarterback? You get to see him. You're going to have a run game that's going to be so difficult to stop because of what Hurts brings as a runner. Then he's accurate when you create open throws. So they're going to scheme around Jalen Hurts, create those open throws. He can hit them. You have Devontae Smith added to the mix. Jalen Reagor is going to look even better as a deep threat opposite Devontae Smith. So back-to-back first-round wide receivers are going to make do, and you still have one of the best defensive lines in the NFL in Philadelphia. Darius Slay in the secondary. Secondary will be better. The D-line is going to be strong. The Eagles, they might be rebuilding. Your hope is more in the future, but they're going to be better than anybody thinks this year because we're optimistic, even in Philadelphia. Washington football team, one of the best offseasons anybody has put together this year. Bring in Ryan Fitzpatrick at the best point in his career. Completely overhauled that wide receiver room over the last couple years. Terry McLaurin has friends now. You got Curtis Samuel. You got Adam Humphries in the mix. So the football team, add Deami Brown too as a deep threat. Washington football team, playmakers, sneaky good offensive line as they had last year. And one of the best defenses in the league. Best defensive line in the league, Chase Young and friends. And a secondary that continues to get better. Added William Jackson this offseason as well. So love what the football team's doing. Are they the favorites in the NFC East? They're defending champions, and they've done even more to improve this offseason. Chicago Bears. Reason for optimism. First franchise quarterback in forever. This one's easy. Justin Fields is in the building. And while, you know, you can look at Matt Nagy and Ryan Pace and say they needed to figure it out. They've done all these other good things, but they haven't figured out quarterback. How about the fact that they have been a playoff team two out of the last 3 years with below average quarterback play, with Mitchell Trubisky under center, or with Nick Foles half the year this past year. The Bears, with Nagy, with Justin Fields in the mix, they've been working some magic with a pretty good, solid roster. Still have a good, solid roster. You have Allen Robinson back, but Justin Fields is there to save the day in Chicago. Transform that run game because he's got a little bit of running ability. Throw the ball down the field. Throw the ball down the field with some accuracy. Can't wait to see Justin Fields in Matt Nagy's offense. Detroit Lions. The optimism is new regime. They got a lot of time here. A lot of time to rebuild this thing. And they started in the trenches. Penei Sewell. O-line is looking great. Penei Sewell, Taylor Decker. Just re-signed Frank Ragnow. How about future first-round picks? The future is bright in Detroit. They're doing the right thing. Matthew Stafford's gone, but they did the right thing to get something for him. Getting future first-round picks is the way to rebuild that team. There's still some talent on defense. I know they weren't great last year. Jeffrey Okuda's going to be better, though, last year's first-rounder. Defensive line's going to be a little bit better. But they're building through the trenches. That O-line is going to be legit. And the Lions have the pieces to build going forward. Optimism in Detroit. All right, optimism in Green Bay. Even with this Aaron Rodgers saga, he's still on the team. We're optimistic. We're staying positive here. Rodgers is going to be back. You got Devontae Adams. You got Jair Alexander, maybe the best receiver, maybe the best corner in the entire NFL on this roster. The Brandon Staley system is coming to Green Bay as well, defensively. The system that, again, turned the Rams into one of the best defenses in the NFL. Just having the new defensive system is going to change things in Green Bay. Get some solid pass rushers up front. We've had one of the best offensive lines over the last couple of years. Green Bay Packers looking strong, and Rodgers is coming back to lead them to a Super Bowl. So, yeah, we're staying positive in Green Bay. How about the Minnesota Vikings? Kirk Cousins under center. He's been solid. He's been good, but he needs some help. And the Vikings got that in the NFL draft. They bring in Christian Darrisaw. They bring in Wyatt Davis. Make one of the best trades in the entire draft to fill two holes on the offensive line, not just one. Kirk Cousins going to have a career year. Seth Galina at PFF.com said he might be a dark horse MVP candidate. We'll see. We'll see. But 26 draft picks over the last 2 years for the Vikings. Overhauling the secondary. Added some pieces to the defensive line. The defense is going to be better. The youth movement in Minnesota combined with Kirk Cousins throwing to those incredible playmakers, Adam Thielen, the Justin Jefferson pick, the best receiver in last year's draft. Plenty of reasons to be excited in Minnesota this year. Let's go to the AFC South. Atlanta Falcons. Got Matt Ryan locked up for 2 more years. He could still ball. And he's got Julio Jones, Calvin Ridley, and Kyle Pitts. Who's stopping that? Who's stopping that trio? Russell Gage was sneakily one of the best third wide receivers in the NFL last year. So you actually have 4 guys to throw to. Hayden Hurst in there as well. Falcons going to be throwing the ball down the field. Might be playing some shootouts, but they're going to put points up on the board. We're going to see the best statistical season from Matt Ryan since his MVP year in 2016, because we're staying positive here. That's what's going to happen. And just like some of the other teams, yeah, the defense was bad, but new defensive system is going to help them. Some of the defense needs a little bit of an overhaul as far as players go, but the system will bring them back on track. They're going to creep back toward average defensively, and the Falcons are going back to the playoffs. How about the Carolina Panthers? Bring in Sam Darnold. It's the best situation Sam Darnold's played in his entire career. You got Joe Brady, one of the best offensive play callers in the NFL last year. Combine that with all the playmakers that they have in DJ Moore and Robbie Anderson, finding a nice steal in Terrace Marshall, manipulating the draft, as Brad said earlier, trading down, picking good players. And then they drafted all defense last year. They add a defensive player in the first round in J.C. Horn. So all that youth movement, the defense is going to turn things around this year. We're going to see all those players in year two, and J.C. Horn as a rookie really come together. Panthers defense is going to be legit. We're going to see Sam Darnold's best season. And there's plenty of reason to be excited with what Matt Rhule is doing in Carolina. New Orleans Saints. Sure, Drew Brees is retired. End of an era. But Sean Payton is still there. Still have one of the best rosters in the NFL. Excellent offensive line. Michael Thomas is back. Alvin Kamara is back. You've got playmakers. You have offensive line. Maybe the best defensive line, deepest defensive line added to the mix. Peyton Turner, first round pick. Looks like another Marcus Davenport or Cameron Jordan type. So loaded on the D-line. And you got a good secondary. You got a good secondary. You have a good back seven. The Saints have few weaknesses on their team. And then you got Tamus. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with Tamus, but I know Sean Payton's going to figure it out. He's going to put the best guy out there. He's going to get the best out of Jameis Winston. Let's really skew positive here. And let's stay on brand. This is the year Jameis breaks out. This is the year we mesh that aggressiveness with not turning the ball over too much. This is the year Jameis becomes a star under Sean Payton in New Orleans. Look at that. We're so optimistic in New Orleans. Tampa Bay Bucks, this is the easiest one. You're returning the entire Super Bowl team. You get Tom Brady, the straw that stirs the drink. We saw the difference last year when Tom Brady shows up with essentially the same roster. Magic happens. You're set up to repeat as champions. And they got off to a slow start last year. They weren't even hitting their stride until week 12 or week 13. So the Bucks have this entire offseason, year two of Tom Brady. Sure, he's 44. It doesn't matter. He's playing like he's 30. So you get Tom Brady, all those playmakers. The defense is back. Tampa Bay Bucks going back to the Super Bowl because, you know, it's Super Bowl or bust for the Bucks. Let's wrap it up with the NFC West. Arizona Cardinals. You got Kyler Murray heading into year three. You got DeAndre Hopkins there. He added a friend in Rondale Moore. AJ Green's going to be rejuvenated as a veteran, as a possession receiver, as the next late career Larry Fitzgerald. But Kyler Murray, huge year for him. Added his legs to the run game last year. How are you going to stop that defensively? Kyler Murray is going to take another huge step forward here in year three. They've got one of the best offensive lines in the NFL. And they've built one of the most versatile defenses in the NFL. J.J. Watt comes in. You draft Zaven Collins. Last year, you drafted Isaiah Simmons. Look at this front seven and what they can do, creating havoc up front. So love what the Cardinals are doing up front, adding Malcolm Butler into the secondary. You got Buda Baker back there. Versatility is the name of the game defensively for the Arizona Cardinals. And they're going to cash in this year in their playoff run. Los Angeles Rams. We get to see Matthew Stafford in Sean McVay's system. Jared Goff's fine. Jared Goff, though, maybe hit his ceiling in Sean McVay's system. I don't know if we've ever really seen Matthew Stafford hit his ceiling. This is the year. We see Matthew Stafford's ceiling combined with Sean McVay. They're rolling four or five deep at wide receiver. Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp, you brought in DeSean Jackson. You got Van Jefferson. They draft Tutu Atwell. Who's going to cover those five for the Rams? Offensive line solid, and then defensively, you get the stars. Aaron Donald, dominant. Jalen Ramsey, superstar at corner. The Rams are loaded on the offense. They're solid defensively, one of the best defenses in the NFL last year. And even with Brandon Staley moving on, Rams are going to be good. And they're making their playoff run. And we can't wait to see Matthew Stafford in Sean McVay's system. San Francisco 49ers. It's Trey Lance time. We get to see Kyle Shanahan's offense 2.0. Let's say 2.0. We get to see the run game component. We get to see him mold a young quarterback. We get to see him take Trey Lance and combine his playmaking ability with Deebo Samuel, with Brandon Ayuk, with George Kittle, with a good offensive line. The great Mike McGlinchey, 15-year veteran over there at right tackle. Trent Williams, the best left tackle in the NFL last year. 49ers are loaded on offense, and they get Kyle Shanahan calling the shots. They got Bobby Slowick, pass game coordinator. What could be better than that? Former PFFer. Forgot to mention that for the Rams. They still have Zach Robinson in the room. That's reason for optimism when you got PFF guys on the coaching staff. But for the Niners, the offense is going to be excellent. The defense is going to be healthy. The D is going to be back. Nick Bosa is back. Defensive line's getting after the quarterback. They brought a whole bunch of pieces back in the secondary. You got Fred Warner in the middle of the D at linebacker. Niners going back to the Super Bowl with Trey Lance as a rookie. Moldable piece of clay at quarterback for Kyle Shanahan. And we're wrapping it up with the Seattle Seahawks. You got Russell Wilson back. And you got Russ with a new system. You're Shane Waldron coming over from the Los Angeles Rams, calling the plays. So now you got DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, draft Dwayne Eskridge. Different skill set, maybe work the underneath stuff a little bit, but still has speed to throw the ball down the field. Russ has been one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL over the last couple of years. I don't care about the slide in the second half last year. Russ is still one of the best. Takes care of the ball, creates those big-time throws down the field defensively. Jamal Adams, Bobby Wagner patrolling in the back seven. Jamal Adams making plays all over the field. Wagner's the best linebacker in the NFL. And you got Pete Carroll pulling it all together. Pete knows how to get these guys motivated, make the most of his roster. So Seattle's going to be right there in the mix once again. Everybody in the NFC West going to the playoffs, going to the Super Bowl, because that's what we're doing here. Team optimism here on the PFF NFL podcast. So there's something to look forward to for all 32 fan bases this offseason. What would Sam say about right now? Sam might come back and bring 32 reasons to just be negative about your team, right, Sam? Is that how you would handle that? But I figured I'd be positive for this year. So there you go. We don't have to just talk about the bad moves your team's made. Everything is going to be great. I can't promise that we're going to stay positive all the way through training camp, but this is the time when you have the most optimism. And there's still moves to be made. So if you do have teams that have a few holes and have some issues, have some needs, still some free agents out there. The team building process does not end. So now, I did tweet out yesterday that I was just going to talk about the 96 Jaguars. So I think this is where we take the show to the next level. Sam's upset about this. He doesn't like when we talk mid-90s Jags. He doesn't like when we talk about baseball. Do you guys want to talk about my baseball career? There's no feedback here, so I can just do it. Now, let's talk some mid-90s Jags, just because a lot of people responded positively. So we talked to Brad. We talked about some real football stuff. We've given some reasons for optimism. But the mid-90s Jaguars were one of the first teams that just gave me a ton of joy watching football. I loved them. 1996, the Jaguars and the Panthers went to the AFC and NFC conference championships. And somebody did ask on Twitter to break this down. How did they do it? And Pete Prisco from CBS.com, I really should have gotten Pete on here because he knows the 96 Jaguars inside and out. I mean, he covered them, did the whole thing, wrote stories on them, the whole thing. But how did two expansion teams, they started in 1995, they both made it to the championship games in 96. Well, it's because they had double draft picks their first 2 years. So they loaded up on the draft. Picture what the Dolphins are doing right now. They essentially got to rebuild their team the way the Dolphins have done it the last couple of years, having multiple picks in early rounds. I mean, they had it in all rounds, and adding a ton of talent to the team. So they had that advantage. The NFL, I don't think, did that with the Browns when they expanded or with the Texans when they expanded. But the Jaguars and Panthers had that advantage. And then they both found quarterbacks. I mean, the Jaguars traded a mid-round pick to the Green Bay Packers for the great Mark Brunell, for my guy. And the Panthers got Kerry Collins. And both of those guys were good, solid starters. Brunell was one of the league's best for a while. And it is fascinating to me. I say fascinating a lot, but it is fascinating to me that a trade for a mid-round pick for a quarterback like a Brunell, who was just sitting on the depth chart behind Brett Favre, much like Matt Hasselbeck was, that those guys existed back then and you could pull them off of another team and win some games. You don't see that a ton in today's NFL, and we get so focused on the first rounders and finding that next quarterback, but there was a world where you could develop quarterbacks, and Brunell was very raw when he started. In 1995, if we were evaluating Brunell in 95, it would look... There was some Johnny Manziel to his game, which sounds crazy because Brunell became one of the best passers in the NFL, but he would go one read, take off. He was an incredible scrambler. I mean, he ran more in 95. He ran a ton back in 95 when he took over as starter. And then in 1996, Brunell led the league in both passing yards and rushing yards. So he ran a ton. He was a Steve Young lookalike as far as number eight, lefty, the whole deal, athleticism. But it was a lot, and it was a lot like Steve Young's development, where I think Young didn't go through progressions and do his whole thing. He wanted to run early in his career. So as much as we sit here and criticize quarterbacks for having flaws, doesn't go through his reads, you know, makes bad decisions, whatever, we've seen players get better through the years. Brunell is one of those guys. And in 1996, he kind of hit his stride. He also led the league in interceptions, had some bad decisions in there, but eventually toned it down. He became one of the best at taking care of the ball. He had to run a little bit less, but he's one of the best pure pocket passers in the league. But the Jaguars, and pull up their draft history. I know more about the Jags than the Panthers, so I'm going to answer those questions, all right? We're going to do 90s Jags. Here's what they drafted in back-to-back years, 1995 and 96. 95, Tony Boselli was their first-round pick. Left tackle, like the classic quintessential 90s left tackle. Second first-round pick is James Stewart, running back out of Tennessee. Had a really good career. They also got a starting guard in Brian DeMarco, starting linebacker in Brian Schwartz, and a starting safety in Chris Hudson. And they also got quarterback Rob Johnson in the fourth round out of USC, who they eventually traded for a first-round pick, which was Fred Taylor, in 1998. And that was based off of Rob Johnson going 22 for 27 in one game, and teams saying, I want that. We're going to trade for the mid-rounder, and we're going to give up a first. So that's... right there, you get five starters and an eventual, you flip a fourth rounder into a first rounder. That's one way the 90s Jaguars became good. Their second draft, 1996, First round, Kevin Hardy, 2 overall, starting linebacker for a while. Really good. Tony Brackens, second round pick. The most underrated player of the Jaguars dynasty. I'm calling it a dynasty. It's all right. They were really good from 96 to 99. It's a mini dynasty in my life. Tony Brackens was Myles Garrett-ish. He was that good. He was that good for much of his career. But then he got hurt. He got banged up, and he was a mess. He had 5 forced fumbles in 96 and in 97. He had 8 in 99. So we didn't have PFF grades back there. But I venture to guess Brackens was a 90-plus player. This is me eyeballing it, watching Brackens play. He had a lot of sacks, disruptions, was always near the ball. He also had 4 interceptions. 96, and he would pick off screen passes. He was that defensive end who was just so incredible at reading the quarterback and just making big-time plays. So Brackens was awesome. They got him in 96. Third round, they got Aaron Beasley, starting corner, who was a baller in 99. So they get him in the third round. Reggie Barlow was their third wide receiver for a while. They get him in the fourth round. So their 95 and 96 drafts in Jacksonville were really good. They just added a ton of talent in the first 3 or 4 rounds. And by 1996, all of a sudden, it's Brunell coming into his own, thrown to Jimmy Smith, Keenan McCardle. They had Andre Rison on the team, but they end up cutting him about middle of the season because he wasn't running the right routes and the whole thing. And didn't like Kevin Gilbride was the offensive coordinator. A lot of option routes. You got to read the defense, and Rison just wasn't doing it. They got rid of him. But that opened the door for more Jimmy Smith, more Keenan McCardle. So then in 96, the Jaguars go to the playoffs, unbelievably. I actually jumped on the bandwagon when they were 4-7. And I watched them play, and I said, I love watching these guys play. I love this Brunell character. And I said, if they win out and they go 9-7, get some help, few other things happen, they'll go to the playoffs. And that's what they did. It's what the 96 Jags did. They went from 4-7 to 9-7, won their last 5 games, won it in incredible fashion. The great Morton Anderson misses a field goal under 30 yards in week 17 to send the Jags to the playoffs. They go to the wild card round. They beat the Bills. The Bills were the AFC team of the 90s. They were a couple years removed from 4 straight Super Bowls. Beat Jim Kelly in his last game. He gets hurt. Jags pull the upset 30-27. Then they go to Denver. Number 1 seed, John Elway, Terrell Davis, the Shanahan system. Denver, this was Elway's time to win the Super Bowl. And the Jags said, nope, not this year. They beat them 30-27. Brunell, big throw to Jimmy Smith to seal the deal. Little fade route. Jimmy Smith should be in the Hall of Fame, by the way. As much as I love Mark Brunell, Jimmy Smith was the guy. Because even when Brunell left, Smith was incredible. What a good deep threat he was. Could win everywhere, but he just won down the field especially. So the Jags beat the Broncos. Then they go to New England, lose to New England. My guy Brunell, interception in the end zone. Was disappointing on a potential game-tying drive late. But the second year in existence, the Jaguars go to the AFC Championship, lose. 97, they're one of the best teams in the league. 98, one of the best teams in the league. Losing the playoffs both times. And then 99 was the heartbreaking season. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. We can't spend the whole rest of the show on the 99 Jags. But the people wanted at least a little bit. But the 99 Jags, that was the year. They brought in Dom Capers. I should get our friend Seth Payne on here. Seth Payne does Houston radio. We've done some work with him before. Seth Payne's on that defensive line. But they bring in Dom Capers, bring in Carnell Lake from Pittsburgh. It was kind of this, they ran a 4-3 defense, 4-3, but it was, you know, the Pittsburgh zone blitzing scheme that Dom Capers, you know, helped make popular in Pittsburgh. So they were getting after the quarterback. Kevin Hardy had a breakout year. Brackens, who I mentioned. Jags had the best defense in the league. They go 14-2. But the Titans, man, their 2 losses in the regular season were the Titans. And then they lost in the AFC Championship to the Titans. And my Jags let me down. It was very sad. That was the year the Titans had the Music City Miracle in their first game against the Buffalo Bills. And that propelled the Titans all the way to the Super Bowl. Steve McNair, Eddie George, their great defense, Javon Kearse. So the Titans had an incredible season, but they beat my Jags. And then Brunell had a nice drive to start the AFC Championship. Then it was all downhill after that. Big Alvis Whitted drop. So think Anthony Schwartz, who the Browns just drafted. 4-2 type of speed. Track speed, that was Alvis Whitted with the Jaguars. Coming out of, I believe, NC State. And he could just just incredible speed. Raw as a receiver had a huge drop in this game in the AFC Championship, and my heart broke. Thought my Jags were going to the Super Bowl that year. I just wanted to see Brunell and the Jags against the Rams and Kurt Warner. That's all I wanted, but wasn't to be. So that's it. That's I can't go any further with the Jaguars. The producers are wrapping me up. They're like, all right, Steve, that's enough. But look, Sam's not here, and it was our time to shine. Talk a little mid-90s Jaguars and some of the fun. It was fun teams to watch. Brunell throwing to Smith and McCardle and watching that defense come together. Tom Coughlin, of course, was the head coach, and he famously absolutely crushed the guys in training camp. I mean, he was a big part of it too. The culture that Tom Coughlin created helped the Jags make it to two AFC championships. And then in 2000, it all fell apart. And as much as we talk about salary cap today and how teams can manipulate the salary cap, there was a point in 2001, 2002, the expansion draft with the Houston Texans, the Jaguars just could not keep all of their players. And the salary cap, it was harder to manipulate back then, so they ended up losing all of their starters. Tony Boselli had to leave. Keenan McCardle had to leave. Brackens got hurt. The whole thing fell apart. But there was a stretch from 96 to 99. Jags could have been a Super Bowl team any of those given years. So there we go. I took advantage of my time, gave you guys something to be optimistic about, had a good little time with Brad. Don't forget, PFF.com. We're still writing. We're still doing everything this offseason. All sorts of just football never ends for us. So if you guys are looking for good NFL analysis, still some post-draft analysis, it's over at PFF.com. I'm going to have a couple winners on Thursday. Oh, by the way, I forgot Thursday. I should have said this earlier. Thursday is the Fro show. So if you guys don't know, we did we had a GoFundMe. We wanted to raise over $1,000. I said I'd do it for $1,000. I'd pick my hair out into a monster afro because I can do it. And, Sam wanted to push this through. He likes to make fun of me, likes to make fun of my appearance. So I said, I'll do it for $1,000. And we did it. We raised the money thanks to you guys. And it was amazing. As soon as we started talking about it on the podcast, the donations went through the roof. And the donations aren't going to me. They're going to a place called Heritage House here in Cincinnati. It's a faith-based program that helps men with addiction recovery. The stories I've seen come out of this place are absolutely incredible. Guys addicted to heroin, to just any drug, to alcohol, whatever it might be. But young men and old men who came through addiction with just incredible stories. Guys that were on drugs and pills since they were 12. I mean, just unbelievable. So that's where the money's going. My wife and I said we'd match every donation. It keeps rising, which is awesome. And I'm happy to do it. I'm a part of this program. I believe in the program, so I'm excited to do it. So I'm more than happy to pick my hair out and have some fun. We're going to do that on Thursday. So that'll be this week. Wednesday or Thursday, we'll be recording it. So stay tuned for that. Appreciate everybody that did donate and become a part of that. And, we'll have a little fun with that. So that'll be this week. The Fro Show later this week here in the PFF NFL podcast. So anyway, that's it. I'm done. I'm losing my voice. It's just me and the open chair. I need a rugby jersey for Sam. Could we get a rugby jersey over here? I miss you, buddy. You'll be back. So Sam took some well-deserved vacation. He's in the cabin in Kentucky, but he'll be back later this week for the Fro Show, talking more things NFL. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll see you guys later in the week. Wave, Sam. Sam's not going to wave.